loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we will discuss with two guests from Venezuela the latest developments in the U.S. orchestrated coup attempt that is underway against the Maduro government in Venezuela. Mike Pompeo, U.S. Secretary of State, said today at the OAS, quote, former President Nicolas Maduro does not have the legal authority to break diplomatic relations with the United States or to declare our diplomats persona non grata. Clearly, the United States government is setting the stage for a bigger confrontation with Venezuela. And then we continue our weekly series. It's every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Senate voted on two competing measures today that would reopen the federal government. Neither bill garnered the required 60 votes, however. And President Trump announced that he will postpone the State of the Union address. This came after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that she would not authorize the address so long as the government was closed. The partial government shutdown is now in its 34th day, with federal workers projected to soon miss their second paycheck. Next, Alex Salmond, who served as the First Minister of Scotland from 2007 to 2014 and who was leader of the Scottish National Party for more than 20 years, was arrested yesterday and charged with sex crimes. The arrest took place 2 weeks after Salmond won a lawsuit against Scottish authorities relating to their investigative practices in the case. Then we continue our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And then a lot of Democrats are running for president. Major media outlets say that as many as 24 Democrats are considering or have already announced campaigns. There are major names like Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren, newcomers like Kamala Harris and Tulsi Gabbard, and unknowns like South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Maryland Congressman John Delaney. But are any of these politicians really any different from previous Democratic candidates? And do many of them even have a chance to beat Donald Trump? And finally, our friend and contributor Ted Rall recently had a major court decision go against him in California. This was a case that had very important implications for Americans' constitutional rights to freedom of speech. In the end, the court decided essentially that Ted's right to criticize the Los Angeles Police Department was less important than the Los Angeles Times' right to block Ted's right to freedom of speech. It's a case with very important constitutional implications. And in other headlines, after 10 days in detention, American citizen and Press TV journalist Marzia Hashemi was released without charge after speaking to a grand jury. The FBI had detained her on a material witness warrant. Talks between U.S.-Afghanistan envoy Zalmay Khalilzad and representatives of the Taliban continued into their fourth day today. The talks were scheduled to last only 2 days, and the extension has raised expectations that significant progress has been made. The negotiations are being held in Qatar, where the Taliban maintains a political office. The Greek parliament today delayed its vote on the controversial deal struck last year over the name of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. Under the agreement, Fyrom would change its name to the Republic of North Macedonia. This would pave the way for the country to enter international institutions like the European Union and NATO. The Department of Labor announced that 25,000 federal employees affected by the government shutdown have filed for unemployment benefits as of January 12th, a number which has presumably increased since the data were collected. 800,000 workers in total are either furloughed or working without pay. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Venezuela as the attempted coup in Venezuela continues. The United States, the Trump administration, is upping the pressure by announcing that it will refuse to remove its embassy staff from the country as ordered by President Nicolas Maduro in retaliation for the U.S. orchestrated plot to replace him with a far-right opposition figure. The U.S. diplomats were given 72 hours by the Maduro government to leave the country. Mike Pompeo made a statement this morning at the OAS saying that the Maduro government has no capability or legal stature to make this order. We're joined from Caracas, Venezuela, by Aline Piva. She is a journalist and a member of Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. And we're joined from Merida, Venezuela, by Paul Dobson. He is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Aline, Paul, welcome back.
Thank you.
Aline, let's start with you. You're there in Caracas. We want to talk about the actual position of the U.S. government now, which is absolutely refusing to recognize the legitimacy and the legal stature of the Maduro government, and thus denying its right to close the U.S. embassy or to expel American diplomats. But before we do that, I want to ask you about the mood where you are, the mood in Caracas, or if there are new developments today.
So what we are seeing in the streets is, which is kind of, interesting, there is a sense of normality. If you compare, for example, with the 2016 protests, very violent protests that we had on the streets, there is not as many, tension going around. There was some disturbances and some focus of violence in this night and yesterday, but it's not as bad as it was in 2016, which is very interesting because the opposition took a very bold move in, nominating Guaidó and everything and the all governments, U.S. or other governments in the region recognizing him. But what you can feel here in the streets is that they don't have, the popular strength to keep this up for long.
That's the voice of Aline Piva. We're talking to her from Caracas, Venezuela. So what she's telling us is that contrary to what one might expect, given the proclamations by the Trump administration, Mike Pompeo today at the OAS or Mike Pence or Trump himself, saying basically the Maduro government is gone. It no longer exists. It has no legal stature. You would think that, and again, the media, Paul Dobson here, was playing and showing pictures of protests of the opposition. You would get the impression here in the United States and certainly in Washington that all is lost for the Maduro government. Of course, those of us who disagree with the United States being able to go and overthrow countries at will have been in the streets for the last day and a half or so. It's pretty startling to hear Aline Piva's report.
Yeah, well, at the moment, we feel a little bit like we're in the eye of the storm here in Venezuela. It is very calm on the streets. People are waiting to see what is going to happen. There's definitely a new hurdle coming or a new situation arising with the expulsion of the U.S. diplomatic team from Venezuela. President Maduro gave them 72 hours to leave the country, which expires on Sunday afternoon. And the U.S. has obviously claimed that they're not prepared to withdraw their staff because they obviously didn't recognize Maduro. So we're going to have to wait and see what happens here and what President Maduro plans on doing if they refuse to leave the embassy. Obviously, it's a very delicate issue with regards to U.S. territory here in Venezuela. But at the moment, things are a lot calmer, thankfully. There's been no outbreaks of violence reported today. And people are a little bit waiting to see what Juan Guaido says or what he does. He's still been in hiding since his self-declaration yesterday afternoon. No one's seen him since. He hasn't made any public statements since. And we're not quite sure where he is. It's a very strange attempted coup d'etat, really.
I have a question, too. Really, for both of our guests, Aline, we can start with you. The military leadership in Venezuela this morning announced their support of President Maduro. What does that mean in the greater context of the potential for street violence? Would that not discourage opposition figures from taking to the streets?
I think there are a few things there. On the one hand, this calm that we see on the streets might indicate two things. One, that the opposition doesn't have the means to actually, wreak havoc as they did in 2016. But on the other hand, in the focus of violence that we saw here in Caracas, for example, it kind of gave us the sense that these were people that were highly trained. What are the things, you know? I think on one hand, it might indicate that they don't have the popular support. You know, people were not supporting this stage of the coup. But on the other hand, that they are organized, they have the money, and they have international support. So what is going to unfold, you know, how this is going to unfold, I think it depends much more on how the international community is going to react to it. I mean, for example, is Brazil actually willing to go to war with Venezuela, or, you know, do an aggression, more open aggression, or are they here going to just stay back and declare Guaido the president? Because if it's so, I don't think it's going to be sustainable in the long term.
Can you just expand on that a little bit, Aline, in terms of what makes it unsustainable?
Yeah, of course. Well, when you look to Guaido, he's not a traditional leadership from the opposition. He's someone that people actually never heard about until the 2016 violent protests. And from that, he kind of was built up to be this new leadership of the opposition. But if you look at the statements of, let's call it, traditional opposition here in Venezuela, for example, Henrique Capriles, former presidential candidate Henrique Capriles, he says that Guaido doesn't have, you know, the strength or the support or even the power to hold on to his claims of the presidency. Also, you look at the declarations of, you know, high officials from the military, from the Supreme Court. They are in support of Maduro. So it's basically someone in, you know, just out of the blue declaring himself president. He doesn't have the votes. He doesn't have legitimacy. He doesn't have the power.
Very interesting. Paul Dobson, your take. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree entirely on this. According to my understanding, the sort of drastic political changes which Juan Guaido is looking to bring about here in Venezuela only come about when there is a certain accumulation of social forces to cause them. What he is trying to do at the moment, or what the White House is trying to impose at the moment, is a social change without this necessary accumulation of social forces in Venezuela. Now, there are a lot of Venezuelans who would like to see a change, that is certain. But to put a puppet man at the front of these people who no one has ever heard of, no one knows anything about his policies, I ask you, would an opposition activist be willing to take a rubber bullet in the leg or suffer tear gas or storm a government building for somebody like him? I doubt this. I doubt this very much. And this is something we're starting to see. There's a lot of enthusiasm in the opposition ranks last night. But today, they're not organized, they're not planning anything, they're just waiting to see if this happens or doesn't happen. Getting back to their usual life, trying to struggle with hyperinflation and the day-to-day problems in Venezuela. And he's not really the sort of man who would inspire people to come and storm a ministry or storm a government building and really bring about the sort of change which he talked about.
We just have breaking news today that Nicolas Maduro has said that he will close the Venezuelan embassy and consulates here in the United States. I don't know if it's for other parts of the world and other countries. Again, Aline, this is breaking news. It seems like what we see unfolding in front of us is this, that the U.S. government has decided to handpick who the next Venezuelan president will be. They then, in their proclamations, brazenly strip the legal stature of the Maduro government, the sovereign government, the legally recognized government, the government that actually won the election, and the government that sits at the United Nations. In other words, recognized by all world bodies as the legitimate government. The Trump administration announces, guess what? That government is no more. When Maduro says, okay, well, we're closing the U.S. embassy in Caracas, And we're meaning we're not necessarily closing it, but we're expelling the current diplomats and breaking relations with the United States. Then Trump and his crew, including Pompeo today at the OAS, say they don't have that right. That's American territory. The new handpicked opposition leader who Trump now says is the president of Venezuela has said that that embassy will stay over. If the Venezuelan government does anything to enforce its obvious legal right, which is the right to break relations with the United States, if it either physically evicts those diplomats or blockades that embassy, does that become then the triggering event for a military intervention, either by the United States or by its proxy ultra-right forces in Latin America? Obviously, people are talking about that here. What's the discussion there?
I think they are looking for excuse, any excuse. Might that be, you know, the diplomats that are staying here? The U.S. is looking for excuse to, you know, go to the final step to take down the government, to implement, you know, by the book regime change in Venezuela. The thing is, people here is very aware of it. And they were expecting President Maduro to do something. I mean, how long can we take, you know, the level of disrespect that the U.S. government has been having with Venezuela? On the other hand, I think this is very symptomatic of the times we are living, right? So the United States doesn't follow any rules. Other countries does not follow other rules. And now they have, for example, the OAS doing, you know, creating new rules to carry out their plans. So that remains the question. I think that is something we have discussed before here on the show. Are we at the point where we are going to have another open war or aggression in the region? It has been a couple of decades, and the United States tried very hard to change that, the perception that Latin America had on that relationship. Are we at that breaking point again?
That's like such an important question. I mean, if the question had been posed to me like 10 years ago, could the U.S. militarily intervene in Latin America, I would say no. I mean, if there's one thing that would unite the continent, would be a Yankee intervention. I also thought that about a U.S. direct military intervention in the Arab world 30 years ago. I really did. I thought in 1980, when the U.S. started to pre-position military bases in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere at the end of the Carter administration, beginning of the Reagan administration, I thought, oh, the U.S. could never physically, militarily intervene in the Arab world. And yet they did. In 1991, the U.S. war against Iraq sort of broke that ice. Anyway, Paul Dobson, what's your thoughts on this?
Like I said before, there is definitely a storm coming here on Sunday with this question. I think the president, Nicolas Maduro, needs or should have a plan B of what has to be done should the diplomatic staff not leave the country. But there's another element to this, guys. This is the commercial element. For the United States, with all of its current commercial problems, the trade war with China, amongst other things, in the cutting of diplomatic and political relations with Venezuela, effectively is going to make it almost impossible for them to do trade with the country. This is already very difficult due to the sanctions, no? But the cutting of relations is going to effectively cut off trade relations as well. And to some extent, the U.S. does depend a lot on Venezuelan oil, but Venezuela also depends a lot on U.S. imports. So this is going to have a knock-on effect for yourself, for the American citizens, and adds to an increasingly complex international trading and commercial picture, which has been sown and which has been drawn up by President Trump.
John, you had your own theory that Trump was looking for a distraction.
I think that's really what it is. The president has been just bombarded with bad news, most of it self-inflicted, over the last, well, really since he became president. But with the government shutdown having no end in sight and the Mueller investigation dragging on, I think that he needed a distraction. And I don't mean to sound too conspiratorial, but we said on this show just a couple of weeks ago that if there was one thing that could distract the American people from our domestic problems. It's a nice, neat, quick little war. And Venezuela is not in a position to defend itself against the U.S. military. And what better way to distract Americans than to launch a brazen public coup attempt, which is what happened yesterday.
I completely agree. I mean, look at the headlines today. Is anyone talking about the shutdown? It's the longest shutdown in the history. I mean, recent research, history of the U.S. government. So it is a distraction, but I would add something else to that. I think there is also a perception that this government, I mean, the U.S. is now in a very good position in the region, let's put it like this. So they have Bolsonaro in Brazil, who is completely aligned, Macri in Argentina, Colombia, I mean, excepting AMLO in Mexico, all the, you know, the more important countries in Latin America are now completely aligned to the U.S. But I think they understand that this is not sustainable in the long term. We are less than 1 month in Bolsonaro's presidency, and he's losing his base of support. You know, people are not more of supporting him as much as they did before the elections. So that could be also the perception of the U.S. government, that they need to act fast and, you know, take advantage of this point, this context that they have right now. So that might be it, too, something that they're trying to, they have been trying for so long, and finally Venezuela is, they put Venezuela in a very fragile position.
Paul Dobson, is the Maduro government, I mean, Guaido, the self-proclaimed president of Venezuela, now with the support of the United States and its allies, its ultra-right allies, he's in hiding. Is the Maduro government seeking to arrest him?
Well, I think this is something which a lot of people here in Venezuela are evaluating at the moment. We're very clear here, and I think the international community and at least those who are in standing solidarity with the Bolivarian revolution have to be very clear. Juan Guaido has committed a crime in Venezuela. Juan Guaido has acted against the constitution of Venezuela. I think this will be the case in any country in the world. If Hillary Clinton stood up on Capitol Hill tomorrow and said, you know, I actually won more votes than Trump, you know, I'm going to be the president now, she would probably be locked away. No, this is normal. This is standard. This is not repression. This is not heavy-handedness. This is not political prisoners. No, this is normal. But is it convenient for the Maduro government to do this? This is a question. No, they have all of the excuse to do it. He has broken a law, he's broken numerous laws. But is it convenient for them to do it? And this is a delicate question. I would imagine in the presidential palace and in his cabinet, they are discussing this at the moment and trying to come to some conclusion. In past examples, for example, with Leopoldo López, who belongs to the same political party as Guaido, they decided that it was convenient to apply justice for the crime that he had committed, no? In other cases, they decided that it was better to leave the person and they went into exile. For example, in the case of Julio Borges, who is currently in Colombia. But it will be interesting to see how they play this hand. But if they do decide to arrest Juan Guaido, I think we all need to be very clear that this is not political repression. This is applying justice to a man who has broken a law.
Yeah, and we know with certainty that while you are right, Paul Dobson, that it's not repression, it's a violation. I mean, someone can't declare themselves to be president of a country, not elected. There was an election. Maduro won the election. The opposition was split between the ultra-right that didn't participate, including his party, and the moderate right, which did, and they lost. It won't be repression. It would be a valid, legitimate arrest. That said, I'm going to read a few sentences from Mike Pompeo's statement today at the OAS, Mike Pompeo being Secretary of State. Quote, the United States stands with interim President Juan Guaido, the democratically elected National Assembly, and the people of Venezuela as they peacefully restore constitutional order to their country. We stand ready to support the interim president as he establishes a transitional government and carries out his constitutional duties as interim president including determining the status of diplomatic representatives in the United States and other countries. The United States does not recognize the Maduro regime as the government of Venezuela. Accordingly, the United States does not consider former President Nicolas Maduro to have the legal authority to break diplomatic relations with the United States or to declare our diplomats persona non grata. We call on the Venezuelan military, again, this is Mike Pompeo today at the OAS. We call on the Venezuelan military and security forces to continue protecting the welfare and well-being of Venezuelan citizens, as well as U.S. and other foreign citizens in Venezuela. So Mike Pompeo has now made it clear that the Venezuelan military, which you are telling us it remains loyal to President Maduro, must do not what President Maduro orders, but what Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo order regarding the status of U.S. diplomats in Caracas. Go ahead, Aline.
You know, it's not only a unilateral decision. It's kind of the U.S. government would like to be, you know, the interim government here in Venezuela. It's considering everything, you know, social conventions, history, you name it. The thing is, and again, I think they are looking for any excuse to start an open aggression. So it puts the government in a very particular condition. I mean, what do you think it would happen if someone just stepped out and said, I'm now the president of the United States? I mean, that's treason. That is, I don't know how many crimes that would, you know, fit into. And here, what they are going to do if the you know, authorities legally and constitutionally, you know, take action against Juan Guaido, they will use it as another excuse to attack Venezuela, right? And also, another thing that they could do, and we might expect, because Mike Pence and Pompeo already said that they have all the cards on the table, is that they take another step in the blockade and finally sanction the oil industry. And that would have, you know, devastating consequences for the people.
Paul Dobson, what's the sense of Venezuela's international standing? We had Bolivia, Cuba, Iran, Mexico, Russia, Uruguay supporting Maduro. China issued a statement announcing their opposition to outside interference. It's not quite the same as an explicit statement of support for the Maduro government, but it's not a complete endorsement of the U.S. In fact, the opposite, but sort of hedging. Again, in Spain, perhaps the same. In terms of the international alignment, what's your take there?
Well, Mr. Trump has in fact made it very difficult for a lot of his, say, less strong allies to back him. The manner in which they attempted, or they are attempting, to oust the democratically elected government, publishing a video a few hours before effectively saying they're going to do it and doing it in such an overt and blatant way, with such disrespect for the national sovereignty, for international law, and for the democratic rights, makes it very difficult for a lot of their partners to support them. If they'd been a little bit more clever about this, countries like Spain and Portugal, who are currently sitting on the fence a little bit, may have actually backed them. I don't know. The countries which have backed them are the hard allies, Canada, Colombia, Brazil. The United Kingdom, in fact, took a long time before today releasing a statement saying they also back this coup d'etat, effectively, without using those words. So I think in the international arena, it's actually fairly easy for President Nicolas Maduro to argue his case. He just has to bring the Venezuelan constitution and bring a couple of international statutes along, including the UN Accord and even the Organization of American States Charter, and show the world that he is the constitutional president and the other person doesn't have a leg to stand on. And we will see a lot of countries, we're already starting to see that a lot of countries, especially in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Asia, saying, we're not going to get involved in this U.S. coup, no way. It's very important, and I say this with all respect, but it's very important to try to break down a little bit this American-centric view of the world, which certain people have, no? The world does not revolve around Washington. There are over 200 countries in the world, sovereign countries. The fact that the United States is one has chosen to not recognize Maduro doesn't mean the whole world doesn't recognize him.
We're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Caracas, Venezuela by Aline Piva. Aline is a journalist and a member of Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. And we were also joined from Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. I urge everyone to go to their website to get the latest, especially if you'd want to know the truth about Venezuela. You can't rely on CNN, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. Go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
It's good to have you both. Let's start off talking a little bit about politics. Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California, announced her candidacy for president this past week. And, you know, at first glance, she was sort of greeted as one of the saviors of the new Democratic Party. In fact, she's not really any different from many of the other neoliberal Democrats that we've seen over the past decade or two. Paul, start us off with Kamala Harris and her position on, let's start with surgery for trans inmates in California. That was something that she had to respond to just recently.
Yeah, so basically, so Kamala Harris was, prior to becoming a senator, she was the Attorney General of California, and I think she's got this ill-deserved reputation as somehow being progressive or, you know, good on issues. And when she was Attorney General, one of the things that her office vigorously defended was efforts by a transgender prisoner who was transitioning from male to female to get gender reassignment surgery. And we report on this case pretty extensively in Prison Legal News because ultimately a federal judge ordered the prisoner to get treatment, including gender reassignment surgery. And I think that, you know, what's kind of telling here is the fact that, you know, I mean, they fought this tooth and nail. And the thing that always kind of surprised me is as a reporter covering this stuff is, you know, the cost of the surgery isn't really that much and is quickly dwarfed by the amount of attorney fees that are being spent on this. And I think the big thing, too, is that, you know, throughout the litigation, you know, she and her attorneys, they denigrated just the reality of gender dysphoria. And, you know, we're trying to, like, minimize it into being, like, you know, some type of elective surgery, like a nose job or something like that. And so, fortunately, the good news is that the Washington Blade, a gay newspaper in Washington, D.C., kind of called her out on this about, you know, hey, you know, when you were attorney general, you know, you bitterly opposed this transgender prisoner's desire for medical treatment. And, you know, she said that she took, you know, quote, full responsibility, which I'm not really sure what this means. You know, it's like, and, you know, I think, you know, my take on it is it just seems like with a lot of these politicians, they try to do the, you know, well, I'm not a bigoted reactionary. I just portray one because I'm an elected official. But, you know, one of the things that didn't get a lot of coverage, or I haven't seen much coverage at all, but we covered in Prison Legal News at the time, was when Kamala Harris, she was arguing against the efforts by the federal courts to reduce the California prison population after it had been determined that overcrowding was resulting in an inability of prison officials to provide medical treatment to prisoners. And one of her arguments against reducing the prison population was that if they let out low-level, nonviolent prisoners, that it would deplete the ranks of prisoners available to be used as unpaid slave labor as firefighters. And, I mean, that was her argument to the court, was that we need the supply of free slave labor to fight forest fires. And of course, you know, and what's bizarre about this and what's, I think, so disgusting about this is, you know, for someone who's an elected official, is, okay, so you really want to keep people caged so you can exploit them as free labor, but when you factor in the cost of how much it costs to keep 5,000 people locked up, it's far cheaper to hire firefighters at prevailing market wages than it is to rely on keeping people caged. And but so she has kind of like this long, pretty reactionary history of, you know, vehemently opposing rights for prisoners, rights for transgender people who happen to be in prison. And, you know, she's an outspoken advocate for prison slavery. But, you know, here she is running for president.
And Kevin, she has kind of a fluid position on the death penalty, does she not?
Well, yeah. So, you know, among other things I wanted to briefly touch upon, she was on Rachel Maddow last night. And I think what's important is while she claims to be opposed to the death penalty now, and it seems to come off as somewhat genuine, she's making a kind of right-wing appeal to voters and saying, okay, I'm opposed to it. I recognize that there's a racism in the system. She's basically taking the position that people within the Supreme Court or maybe in other federal courts have taken when they review cases brought by people challenging their death penalty convictions, et cetera. And so she's saying, I'm going to punish people still to the fullest extent of the law. I'm willing to put people in jail for life. I'm willing to push for the maximum sentences possible for people who are accused and convicted of crimes, which is just, you know, sort of perpetuating the punishment state that is a part of our mass incarceration system rather than seeking rehabilitation for people who are accused of crimes. I just want to say that, you know, one thing's notable about her is that there's the three strikes law in California. And she's noteworthy because in 2012 or thereabouts, there was a ballot initiative that was being campaigned for to change that law. And she stayed out of this. She was silent. She didn't want to take any sort of position on it. And the idea was that they were going to change the third strike so that it had to be a serious or violent felony. It couldn't be a nonviolent crime anymore. And you know, I guess very basically for people who don't know what we're talking about, the idea is that you commit two crimes and then on your third one, that's your third strike. So you get a sentence of 25 years to life for that felony that you committed. And so that exists in California. It's ballooned the population of prisoners there. And she did not really oppose it. And it's not clear that she has any record of opposition to the way the three strikes law functions, even though it's been a huge issue for people who are advocates. And, you know, I think another thing that really needs to be mentioned quickly here is that she backed this heavy-handed truancy initiative in 2010. I don't know if you are familiar with this, but
no, tell us about that, because that's only just recently started to work its way into the news.
So there was a bill that was being proposed, and it was called SB 1317 for people who want to go look it up. It made it so that parents of truant children who missed more than 10% of their classes could be charged with a misdemeanor and given a $2,000 fine or a year in prison if after being offered state support and counseling, their kids still failed to improve their attendance. And in 2009, she actually boasted in the San Francisco Chronicle that she had prosecuted people for truancy, thereby introducing or reintroducing children and their families to a criminal justice system that was already, you know, stacked against them. And so basically, you know, she's someone who is willing to reinforce this school-to-prison pipeline.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, I think Kamala Harris, more than just about any other Democratic presidential candidate, is going to have to answer these kinds of questions because she made her political career on her career as the Attorney General of the state of California. And there are consequences to some of these decisions. There are consequences to all of these decisions, and she's going to have to answer those.
Well, actually, I think Joe Biden has the most odious record on criminal justice of almost any living politician in the United States, except for Bill Clinton.
He felt compelled to come out the other day and say that he's made a lot of mistakes on criminal justice issues over the years.
But he's not doing anything to fix them.
No, you're absolutely right. Well, because we're pressed for time, let's move on to another issue. Kevin, you flagged an article for us about the NYPD retaining photos of Black Lives Matter activists. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the NYPD has been retaining these photos of Black Lives Matter activists. And, you know, again, like I know that within New York City, there's been this huge push among civil rights organizations to obtain these records. This is something that the state usually tries to thwart. They don't want people to be able to have this kind of evidence. But again, it confirms the extent to which the state and these other city agencies are actually monitoring people who engage in dissent. This piece was done by George Joseph for The Appeal. He does a lot of fantastic work covering these kinds of issues. And basically, the NYPD has maintained dozens of photos of these activists who were part of the protests that took place in late 2014, early 2015. They were gathered by undercover officers. And you've got people basically, what law enforcement is doing is they're creating dossiers on these individual activists. This happens. It's not unique to New York. In fact, you see this when environmental activists are engaged in activism against pipelines and other gas projects, and usually with the support of corporations. But what the tactic here is that you put together a sort of file on certain individuals, or you put together a file on an organization that's sponsoring and involved in organizing protests, and then you target them. But I think it's important in New York to say that because they have something called the Hanshoe guidelines, that they're supposed to not be collecting material like this. And so I think the significant thing about this story is calling into question how much the NYPD is still violating those guidelines.
Paul, how is this any different from what the NYPD was doing, let's say, during the Vietnam War or in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 when they were targeting Muslim communities?
Basically, it isn't. I mean, you know, the NYPD, all the city police departments of all major cities in this country, as well as the FBI, I mean, their primary role has always been one of a political police force. And, you know, I mean, back in the good old days in New York, they called it the Red Squad, which I think, you know, they weren't really, you know, trying to hide what they were up to. And I think that that's one of the things is in a lot of respects, it's just never stopped. You know, we've had a continuous surveillance state. And highest priority of the people to surveil is anyone that's critical of the status quo, you know, political or otherwise. And, you know, we've seen some, you know, some changes in the targets. Like after 9/11, we see, you know, members of the Muslim community are targeted for surveillance and harassment and everything else. But just in general, though, it's anyone anyone that's a political dissident, basically, is targeted for surveillance and harassment. And I think that one of the things, it's hard to really, I think, underestimate the chilling effect that this has on people exercising their right to protest, for example. It does intimidate a lot of people. It does cow them. And effectively, it silences people. And the police have always been pretty unapologetic about this. Even when they're caught doing it, it's like, yeah, this is kind of what we do. And to the extent they've been sued about it, you know, despite the lawsuits, this type of illegal surveillance continues.
Yeah, if I could just quickly add, it's important to emphasize that when you go to any protest or demonstration, let's just say basically for this time period, you know, you're against Donald Trump and you want to go to a basic protest against the latest action that Donald Trump has taken, you know, you're going to have police with cameras who are going down the line of people and might be putting it in your face, and you don't know what they're doing with that record. And that sort of thing has been going on for at least the last 10 to 15 years, as long as they've had the technology to approach people. And sometimes they'll single out an individual, and I've seen officers who will actually stay on a particular pocket of people that they want to surveil closely. And I think it was most gratuitous during the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations. Obviously, they've had opportunities since to use their intrusive surveillance methods against people. But I think that was where they really got to show what they do through their surveillance.
I want to turn now to another issue, and that's the issue of this First Step Act that was signed into law by President Trump a couple of weeks ago. We talked previously about this new law, and I think we all agreed that it was a good start. It didn't go far enough. It didn't do anything about mass incarceration, for example. It didn't it didn't appropriate or budget any additional funds for job training or for education or things like that, but it was a start. Now that it's officially law, Paul, tell us how it's going in these early stages.
Well, in some respects, it's kind of interesting is that it's had a very, you know, slow to non-existent start because of the budget, because of the government shutdown, and the BOP has been pretty heavily affected by it with, you know, there's been plenty of media coverage about, you know, guards not getting paid and stuff like that. So arguably the people, the Bureau of Prison staff that are supposed to be implementing it are all at home, not working. So that's been kind of the proverbial slow start. So some of the other stuff, though, as far as like, you know, as far as the sentencing stuff, that's going to basically send a lot of cases, you know, that's going to send stuff back to court where judges are going to have to do resentencing and things like that. I think arguably the biggest portion of the First Step Act, I think, is clarifying Congress's intent on the good time statute so that prisoners are in fact entitled to 54 days a year off their sentence rather than 47, which is what the Bureau of Prisons had been giving them for like the past 30 years. So potentially that has a big impact. But then part of the problem with that is the people that need to recalculate the sentences with the new good time, they're not here or they're not at work. So, you know, I think that's kind of, you know, that's part of the problem. But yeah, but I think the bigger thing though is just that, you know, it's just such a very minimalistic law to begin with. When you look at the sweeping laws that have, you know, revamped our criminal justice system, such as the 1994 Omnibus Crime Control Act, which, you know, eliminated Pell Grants, it massively expanded the federal death penalty, it created three strikes laws at the federal level, it gave states billions of dollars a year to revamp their sentencing laws so they could build more prisons. You know, when you look at these sweeping laws that have basically built the mass carceral state, and then you look at stuff like this that kind of really nibbles around the edges in a very minimalistic way, you know, it's just quite the contrast is that, you know, big, massive, sweeping change to build the police state and then nothing that really challenges it or, you know, like I say, this is stuff that just nibbles around the edges. But this is what passes for reform in this country on criminal justice issues.
Kevin, what are the chances for real reform or at least some additional reform based on this First Step Act?
Well, I think that it does open the door for people who are advocating for reform, as long as they don't let the politicians make this the last thing we do for 10 to 15 years. I mean, we see so often that because it's so hard to pass legislation that addresses these issues because there's just no appetite for it, and because nobody in Congress or the Senate wants to be found responsible or hinge their reelection upon potentially letting somebody out who then commits a violent crime, who then can be splashed around in a campaign ad and used against them, like, let's say, Willie Horton was, even though that was blown up and exaggerated and is not a fair representation of what was going on with the system, it still affected Dukakis. And so I don't think that like Democrats want to take a lot of those risks. It's probably why you get people like Kamala Harris who act the way they do when they're politicians. And so I think as long as people who are involved in these projects, these groups actually push as far as possible for changes, for systemic reform, I mean, as long as they don't allow what they think as the politics of the possible, or as long as they don't say like, this is unrealistic, we can't push for this. If they push for the things that are actually needed to have more justice, then maybe I think sky's the limit for what could be advanced, just simply because as long as people are able to create a groundswell and actually push for it, there's been opportunities for things to actually happen. I think where we set back ourselves and where we really undermine any chances of helping people who are in prison is when we start to think like, oh, this is realistic, this is unrealistic, because really that doesn't capture what has to be done for these people who can benefit. I mean, the couple of thousand federal inmates who are going to benefit from changing their sentences for crack-related crimes, that's crucial. But if somebody had said, no, I don't think we can do this, it's not realistic, they wouldn't get any help now.
I want to move on to another political issue. Just this past year, voters in Florida passed a referendum that would allow the reenfranchisement of ex-felons in that state. Kentucky, however, still bans ex-felons from voting. There's now a lawsuit that would overturn that law or that policy. Paul, let's start with you. Tell us about that and what the chances are that Kentucky could follow in the footsteps of Florida.
Well, I think that there's a critical difference. While the similarity is that both states have long track records of disenfranchising convicted felons. So I think on the one hand, we have that. The difference is that in Kentucky, rather than amending the Constitution, the approach that folks are taking there is filing a lawsuit. And that's also in the context that they also filed lawsuits here in Florida, and those inevitably, unfortunately, they lost. But they, but in Kentucky, they're filing a lawsuit, which hopefully will be successful, but generally so far, not a single lawsuit challenging felon disenfranchisement has ever succeeded.
Repeat that. That's very, very important.
It's very important to note that no lawsuit challenging felon disenfranchisement has ever succeeded. And part of the reason for this is there's a U.S. Supreme Court decision from the early 70s where the court held that the language in the 14th Amendment that said that people will be allowed to vote unless they've been convicted of, I forget the language, but something like a treason, rebellion, or other crime. The U.S. Supreme Court took that language, other crime, to mean basically any crime. And so pretty much over the years, over the past 40 years since then, or 50 years, there's been a multitude of lawsuits challenging felon disenfranchisement using different theories, including the Voting Rights Act, equal protection and things like that. And at the end of the day, though, the courts have always upheld the disenfranchisement of felons. And the theory is because the Supreme Court upheld it under the 14th Amendment, it's perfectly permissible. So for those reasons, I'm not terribly optimistic that this one will succeed just because, I mean, maybe it will, but the reality is, no other lawsuit has succeeded on reenfranchising prisoners and convicted felons that have been disenfranchised.
Kevin, you wrote an important article at shadowproof.com on a lawsuit that's challenging this long-term detention of immigrant children and targeting of relatives of those children for deportation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so thanks for giving me a quick chance to get this in here. It's not really in the realm of what we typically talk about on the show, but I think we should consider them because right now the Office of Refugee Resettlement is involved in a mass detention of migrant children who have crossed the U.S.-Mexico border. These are people who should be getting their asylum claims heard, and they're there. And what happens is relatives who are in the country already, they apply to become sponsors through this agency. But what is happening is that the ORR goes and fingerprints them, and they collect information. And then that information is being shared with ICE. And this did not happen before. This is a new development under President Donald Trump. And then the ICE agents are going and they deport or target the relatives for arrest who are willing to become sponsors. And the targeting of families is actually part of Trump's plan to act as a deterrent against people migrating to the U.S. But like a lot of things in our mass incarceration system, it doesn't really deter people from coming. They're still going to flee violence because they don't want to live with the threat of death from gangs. So this is an important lawsuit, and it's trying to free children who are still in detention and were probably separated from their families, which, by the way, we found out in the last couple of weeks, the government doesn't know how many people were separated from their families.
Yeah, that's true. We actually don't know how many, Paul. There are several different lawsuits around the country that you have written about in Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. I'd like to touch on each one of these. Let's start with three South Carolina prison guards who had sex with an inmate and took explicit photos of themselves having sex with inmates. Tell us about that.
Unfortunately, one of the most common civil rights abuses that happens on a daily basis is prison and jail guards around the country raping the prisoners in their custody. And almost all states ban the practice. It's akin to statutory rape laws in that basically the legislatures have held that prisoners, by virtue of their status as prisoners, are incapable of consenting to having sex with their captors. And despite that, it happens with monotonous regularity, if pretty much almost on a daily basis. We hear about guards and prison staff being arrested for doing this. And in this case in South Carolina, it's kind of like the latest one where three guards have been charged with having sex with prisoners and filming it and, you know, taking pictures of it. And what happens usually most of the time, though, is that, you know, despite all the talk we hear about sex offenders and rapists and everything else, when it comes to government officials and government employees doing the raping and the sexual assaulting, you know, we see plea bargains, we see very light sentences, we see probation, we see suspended sentences, and, you know, very little in the way of actual consequences. You know, it's very different than if, say, for example, non-prisoners were being raped or sexually assaulted on a regular basis. And what's really, you know, what I think is really telling about this is around 10 or 15 years ago, Congress passed the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which I think is probably one of the most grandiosely titled statutes in history. But it doesn't really do anything about eliminating rape. All it does is collect data and statistics. And what's come out of that was we found, and a lot of people were surprised by the statistics that have come out, including myself, is that out of, on average, about the 8,000 or 9,000 prisoners that are being sexually assaulted each year, around half of the perpetrators of the assaults are the prison staff. It's not the other prisoners, which I think is what a lot of people expected. Instead, we're finding that prisoners at the highest risk of being sexually assaulted by the people that are being paid to keep them safe from harm.
And, you know, just as a kind of a crazy postscript to this, these three corrections officers who were arrested for sexual assault are women. And they sexually assaulted a man. So this isn't exclusively, you know, male prison guards raping female prisoners, which happens, of course.
Yes. And I think that the bigger thing, too, is that, you know, it's very much the culture of impunity and the lack of accountability and the lack of transparency that facilitates this. And that's the thing, too, is that we see, unfortunately, we see situations where, you know, female staff assault male prisoners. We see male staff assaulting female prisoners. We also see same gender sexual assaults of, you know, female staff sexually assaulting female prisoners, male staff sexually assaulting male prisoners as well. You know, and again, you wind up with this, you know, you wind up with a situation, though, where the very people that are being paid and trusted to, you know, to protect the prisoners in their care, some of them view that having sex with the prisoners in their custody is almost like a job perk. And especially when you see the systemic levels of, you know, we've reported on lawsuits in Prison Legal News where literally dozens of guards over multi-year periods are being charged and investigated, but then the investigations don't go anywhere, but there's credible evidence that they have, you know, sexually assaulted prisoners. And it's just one of those things where it's just such an endemic systemic problem that I've come to believe that sexual assault is a critical tool of managing American prisons and jails simply because it's so endemic and so common.
We are going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala, who's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of both Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.